Hello and welcome to episode 14 of the 99% podcast. I'm Lucian Waddaly.
I'm Michael McAndrew.
Welcome back to the podcast. We were off last week, but now we're back and ready to go with lots of fun for you on the 99% show.
You just made that up?
Just made that up.
Nice.
We've got a lot to talk about today.
It's a big
show.
We do, and we have a great interview for you.
And we're going to jump right in.
A
great interview with Michael Purcell, a former teacher of ours, a very inspiring figure in our lives, the lives of all of his students.
Yes,
and
sure.
We sat down with him to talk about all sorts of stuff, about the education system in Ireland, the examination system.
Yeah, which is particularly relevant this week.
Because the Leaving Cert results came out and the CAO offers came in.
Yep.
And that affected us both. And he also talks about teaching religion, teaching SPHE, new junior cert reform, just loads of stuff. It's really, really interesting. So you can enjoy that, and it's quite long. But here it is, Michael Purcell on the 99%. And we're joined now by the inspirational educator and former teacher of both Michael and myself, Michael Purcell. Welcome to the 99%.
Thank you very much. I didn't recognize myself with that introduction.
So how long have you been teaching for?
This September will be my 18th year in the one school. One school. So I have kind of the ethos of the school running through my veins at this stage. I don't know any different.
So in 18 years, what do you feel was the most important lesson that you've learned as an educator?
As an educator, I'd have to say it was to lose the ego, my own ego. I remember going in, and particularly teaching religion, it was very doctrinal, and I was trying to force my beliefs onto other students, and it was like, you know, trying to pick up water with a fork. It just wasn't happening, but I couldn't see it because I was completely consumed by my own belief system and how I was trained in college. And particularly because the cohort of students that I've been teaching, very down to earth, you know, there's no bells and whistles. They very quickly knocked the edges off me. And I felt the minute I started losing my own ego, my own sense of that I'm right, I'm the teacher, and it became more of a kind of a cultivating a relationship with students. That was the biggest learning curve for me, because then even if I made mistakes, even if I got things wrong, I was in a position then where I could admit it. And, you know, there was, and students could feel that too. So the biggest learning curve for me was to be able to just kind of, you know, lose the whole kind of the ego, the sense that I'm the professional and you've got to listen to what I say. The minute I lost that, my teaching became much more fluid and natural. And it was a much more welcoming place to go into, I felt, for kids to come into, but also for me to be in. It was a nicer place to be.
And why did you decide to become a teacher in the first? Because that's such a tough...
Yeah.
I don't know how detailed you want to answer that. But
well,
like,
yeah,
it's,
I mean...
It's one of the toughest professions, I believe, anyway, to go into.
And it's not...
Because
I think
it's so... it's such an unthankful job, really.
To be honest, we kind of were our own worst enemies. I know every May, at the end of May, I put a target on my own back by putting up a post on Facebook that what am I going to do for the next 12 weeks? And most teachers kind of, that's the only thing we have to revel in is June, July and August. And it's the three main reasons why some people become teachers. Having said that, from my own point of view, I was deeply religious as a young fella, and growing up, my family was very religious. But my dad had come back to college as a mature student. He became redundant in his job and he was approached to go back to college to teach religion and history. And I was old enough to be influenced by his decision. And I went into college with him every so often, and I'd see the atmosphere, and that's just what I wanted to do. And then I remember being in school, some very inspirational teachers, Mark Fennell, who became principal of Glenageary School in Dublin, and Sister Norma, another teacher. They were just so open, and I said, that's what I want to do. And kids could react to them and respond to them, and they were inspirational. They did. I mean, Mr. Fennell, I only had for 1 year when I was repeating my Leaving Cert, and I was doing a 2-year English Leaving course in 1 year. My previous teacher had told me I didn't have it for English, the flair, you know, the right. turn of phrase, whatever. And I got a D3 with him, and I was told to drop it. And I went off and I worked for a year because I didn't get the points to do to become a teacher. And I was desolate. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I went back and I actually repeated the Leaving Cert in my younger brother's year, which, believe you me, was kind of, that was a tough year. And then because I had Mr. Fennell, and I told him I was going to drop English, and he goes, "Why are you dropping English?" And he quizzed me a little bit about it, and he said, "That's nonsense. You were told nonsense." And he said, "Stick with me. We'll see what we do." And thanks to him, I came out with an A2 in the Honours English after 1 year. So I did the 2 year English course in one, and it was simply because of him. And I remember thinking, if I'm ever going to be a teacher, I need to adapt more of his traits than my previous teacher's traits. And that kind of stuck with me a lot. But it was mainly my dad becoming a teacher. So I went into the same college he went into. So that was where it started.
Teaching religion over that 18 years, how has teaching it developed, changed?
It's changed dramatically. I mean, you wouldn't recognize... Well, to be honest, if I tried to do now what I used to do when I first started teaching, I'd be laughed out of the place. And plus, we now have the new syllabus for junior certificate examination, religion. So it's a completely different landscape. I think the new junior syllabus has given a status to religion. Beforehand, it was a case of, you know, colouring pictures, watching videos, and just trying to keep them contained in a room. And it was seen as a DOS class. There was no status to it, like you would have in maths, English, or Irish, where it was seen as an important subject. So when we brought it in, I suppose about 10 years ago now, we brought it in. Just it was off the cuff. We decided, you know, teachers are hoarders of information, and we kept collecting resources and trying to reinvent the wheel to try and keep kids interested. And when the new curriculum came along, it was a breath of fresh air for us because it gave us structure. We were teaching something, and the big thing about it was it was quite broad in the sense that there was a section on major world religions. So it wasn't just the Catholic doctrine and what was in the catechism and what we were taught. It was a case of broadening the spectrum. There was a whole morality section, do you know? There was the history of religion, the foundations of religion. And they subsequently brought out the senior cycle religion exam, which we don't do in our school, but we take a lot of our material from, which goes into kind of the origins of religion, and it expands on justice and peace and all the rest. So, like, there's a much broader approach to religion, but also I think teaching religion now in the present landscape, where the church hasn't necessarily kind of cloaked itself in glory with the abuse scandals and all the rest, people have a completely different approach to religion. Now, institutional religion, what I have to say quite clearly is belief in a god or gods hasn't changed. I'm fascinated each year by the amount of first years who come in who believe in something, but they just don't know what it is, and they don't know how to get there. And how I approach it is I kind of tell them it's like kind of starting in Galway and driving to Dublin. There is, you know, you can take the motorway, you know, through Athlone. That's one way of going. But there are 10,000 other ways you can go to get to the same destination. And for people like in my class now, let's say coming in, incoming first years, I will have a large cohort of Muslims sitting in front of me, whereas I wouldn't have had them 18 years ago. I have one or two Buddhists. I have quite a lot of atheists sitting in front of me, and we had the big problem we're faced with now is exemptions from religion, because the parent is seen as the primary educator of their child. They can decide whether their child does or does not do the religious education. Now, we're a Catholic school, we're under the auspices of the bishop, but we don't have the right to force a religious education on a child. So I have a situation where, particularly last year, let's say, where I had 24 kids sitting in front of me and 8 of them were exempt, but they had to sit in the class. So you're very conscious of this. Sometimes, I mean, I would be teaching Islam in second year, and some of the Muslim children would pipe up and get involved. And the dilemma you have then is you're exempt, your parents want you exempt, but, you know, you're actually wanting to participate. So you've got to facilitate that, and I encourage that. But the big, I think for from my point of view, teaching education, religious education, the big problem is the attitude of the parents. They think it's all doctrinal, you know, learning the catechism, learning about the sacraments, when in actual fact it's much more vibrant and living and
real.
Do
you think it could be more objective in its view of, like, Catholicism maybe is treated as a primary source of the course?
Yeah, well, you see, at the end of the day, I mean, it's a school owned by the bishop.
Do you know?
And it is very much founded in the Catholic ethos. But, I mean, where I would kind of... where I would expand a little bit is, and I hate this phrase, and I have to blame the Americans for it, is what would Jesus do? Mm. Do you know that phrase? You know, where it's a case of like, nothing we do is against Catholicism. It's open to all faiths and no faiths. And it's, I mean, I spend my first year just facilitating questions, you know, telling them about, you know, Adam and Eve didn't exist and they're fascinated by this. And hang on, we were all told in primary school, this is what happened and all that. Mm. And their little minds are blown. And then you're trying to kind of repair it gradually by saying, well, look, their stories. They're,
the conflict between the way it's taught is a very kind of clear, factual thing. And between being taught as a particular viewpoint of belief.
And unfortunately for a lot of them, they're taught in primary school for an end game, for your confirmation, for your Holy Communion.
Yeah.
That's basically what you're what you're taught. There's no questioning, there's no challenging, there's no exploring. What I love to see first years doing is deconstructing the information, taking it apart. That's a lie. That's not, how could that be? That's and then saying, well, look, if you explain it and say how, where the symbolism comes in and what it stands for and the how things have evolved, our understanding, our the concept of even something as major as revelation, things were revealed to us years ago, and you know, there maybe we don't have as many miracles now, but our understanding of things are constantly changing, and that kind of gives them the concept that this is not, I'm not going to teach you something that you're going to believe for the rest of your life. I'm going to pose questions, and I'm hopefully going to plant a seed that will grow, and that will, you can take with you then and do with as you will, but give you the right kind of foundation in order to explore that. You
do
know?
You think that philosophy and ethics could be taught as an additional or as an alternative subject kind of to religion, or maybe the children who are exempt from religion could be studying the more moral side of it without the doctrine?
Well, what we tried to do in our own school, I mean, we've tried a couple of different things to try and facilitate. I mean, technically, the kids who are exempt from religion, if they're allowed to do their homework, they get an unfair educational advantage because they're going off doing, you know. So
they should be studying something on a similar.
So note. What we did was, myself and another teacher in the school, a very, very kind of far-thinking individual, he decided that we would give them chapters from Sophie's World, a great philosophical book to read, and give them questions at the end of it. Yep. So some of the kids were getting completely engrossed in this, but again, it's not an ideal situation because there's an actual class going on and they're trying to read this and engage in this, and some of them want to get involved in what's going on in the class, and it just breaks up that continuity for them. But philosophy and ethics does, I mean, it has to come in, particularly in the morality section, but you kind of, you try and kind of infuse philosophy in every section because you're trying to, you know, again, question the information. Where does it come from? How do we get there? Why do we think this? And, you know, you're trying to get them to say, well, look, your parents will think this way. Your grandparents might understand this, but things have changed. And to understand that concept is quite a difficult thing to do.
If the name of the subject was changed, like religious and philosophical education, there might be less exemptions even if parents thought that it was a broader course.
Well, I mean,
just from the name even.
I mean, we do have a facility in the school where we encourage parents to come in to discuss the curriculum with us, and we sit down and we go through them, and when they actually see what we're doing and they realise it's not the old school way of kind of, you know, indoctrination, they actually are quite welcoming of it and encourage it. But in my experience, I have found some of the students who are exempt are actually the most introspective and most, and I mean this in a positive way, most challenging and questioning students. They bring so much, they bring a different objective to the class, and particularly, let's say, students from different faiths. It's a great resource to have them in the class, whereas something I don't know, you ask one of the Muslim children and they can give you the answer, and they feel part of it. They're now kind of informing other people, and whereas they might have, the whole word exemption, they might have felt kind of isolated from the rest of the class, now not only are they participating, but they're actually kind of leading the class in some way, and that's very empowering for people. So that's the change in the name. I think it's just about moving goalposts, really. I think, I mean, we're still steeped in our Catholic history. And, I mean, the fact that we're run by the bishop and owned by the bishop, you know, we do have a certain responsibility in that regard. But, I mean, the vast majority of the students in my class would not go to Mass. I mean, I remember one year out of 23 children, 18 didn't know how to bless themselves properly. Do you know, so when you're trying to deal with that and then try and tell, and particularly when they're coming from more disadvantaged backgrounds, to tell them that God loves them and God is always there, when there may be very few other people in their lives who are there, they don't know how to base their concept of God on. You've got to completely start at the beginning, and you've just got to allow their questioning. So philosophy and ethics would make a better name for it, but I think the wider concept of education needs to change as well. I mean, with most subjects, you're giving them a curriculum and it's pretty much rote learning. Mm-hmm. Learn that off by heart because you're going to have an end exam. Mm-hmm. And if you learn it off properly, you know, you'll get your just reward in a letter grade at the end of it. Whereas if they're encouraged to critically analyze and question and challenge, and as I said earlier, deconstruct the information, reconstruct it, they know it deeper, and they have a much better understanding of what they're doing. And that's something that'll last with them, as opposed to, I mean, I learnt logs, but I've never used them since. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's that kind of empowering students for a lifetime of continual learning, which is what I try and show in my classrooms, that I'm constantly learning. But it's not just kind of I'm learning this for an end result and then that's it. It's a kind of neat little package that I never need to use again. Mm-hmm. So yeah, change the name, but I think you need to kind of broaden the spectrum and kind of look at the curriculum itself and what it tries to do.
I mean, if you look at Ireland now, the state are basically trying to reform the whole education system, and they're starting with the junior cert, right?
Yeah.
But I guess it's their attempt at trying to modernize the education system and try to take the emphasis off exams. Am I correct in saying that?
Well, yeah. I mean, that whole term of, you know, reform, who's against reform, it's a bit like kind of the war on drugs and, you know, support our troops.
Yeah.
You know, there are things that don't actually exist, but everybody feels they should, you know, they should be part of it. Reform education. Sure, reform education. Our esteemed previous minister, Rory Quinn, in his infinite wisdom said, you know, that his reforms to education were too important not to implement immediately. But education is too important not to question what you're changing and why you're changing it, and have the end result, what you want to achieve, in mind, not just reform for reform's sake.
Yeah.
I mean, just in our conversation here, and I'm thinking about it quite actively now, the 18 years that I've been teaching, I've been forced to reform. You know, I mean, when I first started teaching, you didn't have to give homework. Do you know? There was no accountability to parents. You just went in, you did your thing. It was an insular experience in my classroom, and I was the king in my own classroom, and nobody challenged that. Sure. Whereas now you're open to, and rightly so, there's accountability, there has to be transparency, but I have to account for what I'm doing in the classroom, and I'm constantly reforming. But because the department have said we need to reform, the reforms that they brought in didn't actually consult teachers, who were the very ones that they were hoping would implement the reform. They didn't look at the long term. And I'll be honest with you, the reforms tend to be more about an economic experience of you know, shrinking their education budget. That's to me. Now, I could be very cynical, and I'm open to and would welcome any correction on that. But when you look at what they're doing and how they're doing it, it just seems to be, how can we save money?
And also they seem to be very much open to external influence from, for example, from industry. So, like
focus
in Ireland,
on maths and science.
It's becoming more and more just maths and science driven.
To train workers.
And again, as you're saying, to focus on the CAO, the points, when you come out. What are we producing when we come out? There's no concept of the student who's engaging in that educational experience. As part of the junior cert reform, IBEC are sitting on the NCCA Council for changing the curriculum. I mean, and I've no problem with that. Sure, we need to have kind of students coming out who can actively and fruitfully give back to the society.
Yeah.
But look at what our education system is telling students when they come in. Extra bonus points for maths.
Yeah.
Do you know? Maths is the kind of the holy grail of the education system. But it's pervasive in our society. And again, it's our societal mentality. Education is about what you get in your Leaving Cert, what you go on to do in college. It's not about who you are or how you develop or expand. Look at our news system. Our news is built on the economy, who's doing what, and then we break to sports. And schools are the exact same. They're based on learning, and if you do sports, you're even better. Where do we celebrate the arts? Where do we celebrate literature and drama? Why isn't there extra points for English, for creative writing? Do you know? Why isn't there celebration of students whose personal development? I mean, students who are coming in are facing much greater difficulties at home than they're facing educational learning difficulties. And yet, there's no account taken into that. They're expected to just learn this off by heart, regurgitate it in an exam, and then we'll grade you on your ability to remember. Whereas, we're not looking at the, I mean, on paper, we're supposed to look at the holistic education of the child.
Yeah.
But I personally feel we're failing the holistic education of the child.
And that's the beauty of that in many ways has been the beauty of the primary and secondary education system is the diversity of it. And to expose children to all different types of learning so that, you know, whatever they feel that they want, you know, to give them that experience so that they can, a broad experience, so they can find out for themselves what interests them.
Exactly. And that's the Norwegian model and the Finnish model, which everybody points to as being the way to go in education. But the problem is that while our education minister and the Department of Education, in their infinite wisdom, this is what they're pointing to, they're expecting it to be achieved on a third world budget for education. They don't invest in it. You know, students should be allowed to explore, challenge, question, but then also be facilitated to take that further. Our education system is based on they're coming in first year, and hopefully we're going to get them into college because there's league tables there that place us against another school down the road as to how well we're doing based on how many students we sent to college. The European model, the broader European model, tends to be more about apprenticeships. You know, go out and do something that you're interested in. Explore this. Go on to drama school, you know, after your junior cert. The reform of the junior cert, in essence, is a great idea because it facilitates different styles of learning. It's not just kind of the rote learning, but it's not thought out. There's no funding for it. There's no padding out of our thought of how it's going to be done. And what I think personally is a huge detrimental flaw in the government's reform of this is they want teachers to grade their students. Now that to me it just is a bridge too far, because it is the student teacher relationship is sacrosanct, that they're working together and they know that at the end of this exam or of this period of study, their exam will be externally assessed, that the teacher doesn't have that power of attorney to grade them. And when a student feels that they have that, well then I think it takes from the essence of the classroom, the relationship, the student-teacher relationship in the classroom. And the government, again, I mean, somebody as cynical as I would say that it's to get the teacher to grade the student is just saving on the State Examinations Commission down the road. It's just saving them a couple of million down there. Again, along with the reform, there's no investment in IT. There's a huge emphasis on students collating a digital portfolio where they can collate all their work from first to third year. But, I mean, if you haven't got an even basic functioning computer room in your school where you don't have access to Wi-Fi, how are you expecting teachers to facilitate this digital portfolio when they haven't got the basics? So reform is great, we're all behind reform, we've been doing it inherently for years, but there's no joined up thinking. Look at what's happening. You have the junior cycle that is brought in with English 2 years ago, and now with science and business, a whole different way of learning. But when they've done their junior cert, they've got to go back to the old leaving cert way of rote learning, and it's like two different languages. And you know, which is more important? Some would say that, you know, the junior cert, it gives them a good sense of how to learn, whereas the leaving cert, you've just got to get on with it. The leaving cert needs reform too. Do you know? But again, it's the bigger concept of, as a society, do we want workers in a factory and to just, you know, produce people who for a fit purpose that IBEC dictate, or do we want a society that that values the people that are in it and what they have to contribute, no matter what that is? Do you know? So yeah, reform is good, but it needs to be much more. There needs to be more clarity around it as to what we want to achieve with this. There's no end goal thinking, do you know?
In terms of incorporating technology into education, you've you know, experimented with using it in your classroom a bit. How has that fared so far?
Oh, I love it. I mean, I've gone to quite a lot of, again, we're talking about reform, and I've gone to a lot of in-service and continuous professional development on this. Yes, technology is the way of the future. It's the way things are going, and I think there's a huge place for technology in the classroom, but it shouldn't take away from a student's ability to put pen to paper. Mm. I mean, in some schools where they just have completely transformed over, it's just a case of, you know, everything's autocorrect. You just email your homework and it's emailed back. And there's a place for that to a certain extent, but it should aid education. It shouldn't be kind of dictating how it's learned. I've tried different things out, but again, and it's not my school's fault, but it's just the way that where we're at the moment. You know, the facilities aren't necessarily there to go in that direction. Mm-hmm. But I mean, again, it's a tool, it's a resource that should be used and should be encouraged to use. But again, the wider thinking is, well, you know, there's cyberbullying. There could be, you know, the internet user policy may not be watertight, and you could have kids going on Facebook or Snapchat, and there's that fear of it too, and that needs to be, again, that's a discussion that, you know, schools need to have. What is it we want to do with this? Where do we want to go with it? And you work your way back from there. You know, and but I mean, there are a lot of teachers in our school who are just firing ahead with it. A lot of us have our own websites where we, you know, encourage kids to go on and look at the information in their own time. There's a lot of contact through a site called Edmodo where homework is put up or resources are put up, and the kid can learn or the student can learn at their own pace at home, which is a great benefit to them. So from that point of view, it's invaluable, but it shouldn't be the be all and end all either. You know.
Yeah, and what I found is that, well, at the moment we're kind of in a generational transition. So there is a younger generation who would be a lot more who'd be coming in as teachers now, much more technology, you know, much more tech savvy than an older generation who would not have grown up with technology. But what I found is even younger teachers who are coming in as new teachers now into the education system, like, they have said that there's still no, they've gone through the training college and everything without ever having to even touch a computer. They've never been told about how to incorporate technology into their teaching methods. That seems now like a big problem.
You see, that goes back to the whole idea of reform for reform's sake. They're reforming the junior cycle, and they're, you know, they're telling the teachers that this is what they have to do, and if you don't go with it, you're against reform. But the bigger picture is that teachers aren't being trained to incorporate this in their teaching methodologies. Now, like what you said there earlier about, you know, teachers or the younger generation being more tech savvy, I would see it that they're not technophobes. I mean, I remember my own father, and it taken him nearly 18 months to learn how to double click on a mouse. You know, it was a click and then a click, and because it was a case of having to learn something and you're afraid you're going to damage it or something, whereas my son, when he was about 18 months, could open a file doc, or 2 years old, he could open a file document, do a new painting, and, you know, and then do open another document because there's no fear of it. The problem that when you talk about tech savvy, people know how to use it, but they don't know actually how to use it as an educational tool. So you're dead right. So trainee teachers, they need a course in this. What I find in a lot of schools is it's the teacher who maybe has done the CPD in it or has done the in-service, they're the go-to person. And again, it goes back to the investment in schools. I mean, in a lot of schools in other countries, they have a lab technician. They have an ICT technician who are on hand to sort out any problems. I mean, we have a data projector and a desktop computer in every classroom, and most teachers are very adept at using them. But the slightest thing could go wrong, and you know, their whole kind of, or the Wi-Fi may be down, and their whole class lesson might be gone. But it's about not replacing the skills, the ability to kind of think on your feet as a teacher with technology, but incorporating it and using it. And it definitely needs to start at the teacher training stage, because just expecting teachers of 25, 30 years to indoctrinate themselves into this technology is unfair without the adequate training. I mean, the new reform for the junior cycle, English teachers got 1 day of an in-service. And during that 1 day in service, they weren't told about how it was going to be examined because the department didn't know yet. They weren't told about what textbooks were going to be used because the department didn't know yet. And this just highlights the lack of vision, the lack of joined up thinking, and saying, right, what is it we want to achieve, and how are we going to get there with our teachers coming in? If there's a reform going on at the basic curriculum level, surely you would think that the teachers being brought in the line to teach it should be informed of it. You know, most of them haven't a clue what's expected of them when they come in.
Yeah. So, like, as we stand now, what does the reform actually mean? Like, how how far along the process is the state at in you know, implementing this reform? Yeah. And what does it actually mean? I mean, what is ground. To change on the okay. ground level?
Yeah, well, basically, the department is full steam ahead.
Okay.
And declaring my interests, I am a member of the ASTI who have voted quite overwhelmingly to reject the new junior cert reform in its current state, simply because of the dramatic change it's making. As I stated earlier, it expects the teacher to grade the student in a lot of cases. Now, that has been drawn back. It was 100%. It's back down to 40%. But even for me as a teacher, I don't think even 40% is acceptable, because I shouldn't be expected to grade a student who I've been working with for 3 years. Surely I can mentor them, I can coach them, I can be part on the journey of their learning, but I still believe the assessment should be external. Now, the changes that are taking place, which the government are going full steam ahead with, you see, I'm obliged under the Education Act to teach whatever syllabus the minister of the day implements. So while English has been in for the last 2 years and science and business are coming in, all teachers are obliged to teach the syllabus. But because of the reform and the way the reform is going, we have voted not to engage in the assessment part of it. There's things like classroom-based assessments where students, let's say in English, will get up and they might have done a presentation, and I would be expected to judge it based on their presentation and their research. But I'm expected to do that in one class period. Mm. But I have 27 or 26 other students mm. sitting in the classroom while this one. I don't know whether that student has had help at home, mm. has right. you know, has had a brother who's in college, or somebody helped them out with it, or an uncle or whatever, or an aunt, or whatever. So it's not an optimum assessment.
The level playing
yeah,
field.
Yeah, level playing of, field. It's yeah. not. Some kids go home and they'll have a parent who works in a college who can help them out in a university, or a background where education is encouraged mm. and promoted. Other kids will go home and there may not even be a book in the house, do you know?
Sure.
So there's not a level playing field, which the old system ensured that they weren't judged on who they were or where they were coming from. And I mean, one of the big fears is in rural parishes, you're going to have teachers living with parents and next door to parents of their students, you know, and there is, yeah, you know, teachers are saying that we're not corruptible, but we're human. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a, you know, you're at a football match or a hurling match or whatever, and, you know, one of the girls in your guys in your class, their parent comes up and says, how come little Johnny or Mary isn't getting this grade? Mm. There's a pressure on teachers there. That should yeah. not be the case, mm-hmm. because then that takes away the authenticity of education.
Yeah.
The reforms are going on and based on changing how the students learn. It's encouraging them to interact with the information themselves, which is a great thing, but it's still putting the onus on the teacher to inform that process and then grade it and assess it. There's no resources given to it. Teachers are expected to meet on a regular basis about each individual student, which if I've three or four classes of let's say religion, it's going to be impossible for me to timetable to meet with another religion teacher to make sure we're all doing the same thing. I think it's, to a large extent, it's reform for reform's sake. There's very little joined up thinking. And at the end of the day, all that's happening right now is the student is suffering.
Mm,
they don't
right.
know where their education is going at the moment. And the department is just ploughing full steam ahead. They're not engaging properly with the unions and the vested interests. I mean, it wouldn't happen in the medical field or the legal field, where just sweeping changes would be made and without consultation with those who are implementing it, and just expect them to roll along with it, you know?
Mm.
What they've done is, by the department going full steam ahead, they've actually isolated teachers. They've set us apart, and they've said that we're the problem, when in actual fact, you know, we are the solution. We've always been the solution. I mean, we have an education system that is the envy of many European countries. It's up quite high in the field, with a third rate funding, and we do an awful lot. I mean, as I was speaking to you earlier, if you, let's say, just take the classroom content out of it, the contact that a teacher has with a student, that is not the be-all and end-all of the Irish education system. You have geography teachers going out and taking a hurling team at lunchtime. You've got English teachers taking a debating team. You've got teachers who meet students on a corridor and just have a good word for them. Or students will know who to go to with a problem or an issue. Mm-hmm. You've got a multitude of extracurricular activities going on. In our school, lunchtime, there's never a free space. There's always something going on.
Yeah.
And teachers give freely of their time. But that is being gradually eroded by the government, basically, with this rush to the bottom line. What can we get the most amount of with the least amount of investment?
Right.
And unfortunately, they're seeing teachers as a commodity that they can exploit, as opposed to, we want the education system to do well. That's why you don't get into teaching for the pay. But the conditions are gradually worsening, where we're not being encouraged to take on the likes of the reform that's coming in, because we're not being supported through continuous professional development, investment in the resources that we need. So while the new junior cycle idea works well broadly, the intricacies of it and the actualities of it are far from ideal. Mm. Do you know?
Right. But if I was just to play devil's advocate for a minute, the current education system only really examines students on a very, very small portion of their intelligence.
Absolutely.
And to me, it feels like the argument could be made that the teachers know the students better than any external examiner would ever be able to. Mm-hmm. And that they are also in a position where they can
put it in context, and they can take other factors that might be affecting the student's performance into account.
Okay, but while that sounds like a positive thing, that has a negative impact as well. That has a negative flip side. So yes, by all means, I could see a student who has struggled, a student who has overcome huge adversity at home or learning disabilities, and has achieved, let's say, in their time frame, much more than most, and I could grade them accordingly. But similarly, I'm human. I might look at a student and say, "Do you know what? Now, you know, you're wasting your talent, or you're not putting the effort in," and mark them down. Or I'm human. You know, that's what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excuse me. The other problem is that while you're saying that, you know, the teacher has a great insight as to where the student has started from and what they've travelled through and their end result, well, then surely the education system needs to change to cater for that development. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll be honest, I feel kind of privileged in my own school that the management in the school have the vision to introduce, for want of a better word, it's SPHE, it's senior cycle. Mm. We call it personal development. Mm. We had SPHE, I'm a teacher of SPHE as well, and up to third year you do, awareness, assertive communication, mental health, and that stops at third year.
Do you think that course is good in its current form?
Yeah, to a certain extent, but you see, it depends on its delivery.
Because a lot of it is very... the way it's taught, or the way it's in the textbook that is sold, I think is very difficult to access for students.
It is for students, but because, unfortunately, for the likes of SPHE and to a certain extent CSP, it becomes a timetable filler. It's given to teachers just to fill up their timetable. Mm. They have no adequate training in it, and you have to have a passion for it. Now, again, let's say the SPHE in our school is run quite well up to third year. There was a void, a gap. We were finding the resilience of kids, that their mental health was suffering dramatically in senior cycle with the pressure that the Leaving Cert in its current form places on them, and the management decided we'll trial this personal development. Now, initially it was to incorporate RSE, which is the relationship and sexuality education part of the course, which is greatly needed but is much overlooked. A lot of teachers don't feel comfortable teaching it, and again it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the societal change. Some parents just will not talk about it, you know, at home. So kids, the only contact kids will have with this very integral part of who they are is in schools. And if you have a teacher who does not feel comfortable teaching it, that comes across. And it's the same with most reform. If you're expecting a teacher to do something that they don't feel comfortable doing, the student will pick up on that. And therefore you're kind of you're belittling what you're trying to do. And so, yeah, SPHE is good. Again, in our school, and I think it's quite inspired, we have the SPHE course, but running alongside that in first year, we're now doing the personal development. Mm-hmm. So the SPHE covers the course. It does healthy eating. It does substance abuse. It does all that side of things. The personal development then is much more flexible, and it's one class period a week that allows to deal with issues in the classroom, like a bullying incident or, you know, some kind of personal issue that might be relevant to the year group or the class group. We had a situation a couple of years ago where there was, you know, an issue regarding the sexuality of somebody. And it could be dealt with across the board in first year in this personal development class. And it normalized it. It took the sting out of it, took the rumor, the kind of the gossip aspect out of it. And it just became normalized. And again, it depends on the comfort level of the teacher teaching it and the amount of investment into their CPD. And I have to be honest, our school have invested greatly in that. And we're now bringing it in. It's in a senior cycle level and it's proving to be very effective in that the kids lap it up. They love it because it's about them. It's integral to who they are. And that's what education should be doing rather than giving them these kind of, you know, these adverse things that they just need to learn off once and then move on and never come back.
Have you noticed change in the way that the class responds to the teaching of the personal development course in terms of a kind of a cultural shift in attitudes certain issues?
Yeah, I'm teaching personal development now. This will be my second year. Before that, I used to kind of basically swap with teachers to fill in for the ORSE because it is an obligation of the curriculum. But I'll be honest, the last, I've been teaching SPHE pretty much since I started. It's one of the few subjects that I would teach that would rarely have a discipline problem because it's about the student. It's about the individual. And again, I teach it in a very open and honest, and sometimes I learn more than they do. And frank questions are asked and I may not have the answer, but somebody else sitting there will. Let's say it's completely different to teaching, let's say, the junior cycle religious education or the English at Leaving Cert, whereas you're under a strict time frame, you've got to get certain things done and got to get boxes ticked. Personal development is exactly what it says in the tin. It's about the development of the person. And that can't be rushed and that has to be fluid and that is facilitated in our school, which I think is very visionary. Very few schools have, let alone the SPHE at senior cycle, but even have that extra personal development class at a junior cycle level as well. You know, it also facilitates the bigger the bigger spectrum of the, let's say, the pastoral care side of the school, where you've got a year head, you've got an assistant year head, you've got the chaplain who works with the year group, and they meet once a week as a care team. And what I do in the personal development class is very much kind of geared and based on what that pastoral care team have come up with. There may be an issue in the year group and I can respond to that in the personal development class. So there's a very joined up thinking about how we approach the issues that are relevant to our students. And a one size fits all Leaving Cert can't be flexible enough to facilitate that and encourage that. And that's where the system really needs to change. It needs to kind of meet students where they're at and try and kind of move from there, you know.
So you said that a one-size-fits-all Leaving Cert is just not really. Where do you go from there? So if you're saying that you can't move to an exam, I mean, we have to be able to, I guess, examine students in some way.
Yes.
And if we can't go towards a teacher-based examination system, where do we go?
Well, again, I mean, the State Examinations Commission has done a good job up to now. I mean, the integrity of the exam as it is cannot be questioned. You know, the results stand and they are what they are, and people respect them as such, and that has been tried and tested for years.
So
there's no, like, if it's not broken, don't fix it. But what I'm kind of proposing, and it's a case of just looking around at what our European neighbours are doing, we don't have to push all kids in the one direction, because not all of them, as you were saying earlier, Michael, you know, we're only examining one aspect of learning or of intelligence. You know, look at the more practical side of things. Do you know, get kids out doing things. And I mean, I can think of very many students who, while they sit down and do their Leaving Cert, and they may not do very well in relation to other students in their year group, their charisma, their way with people, their ability to overcome adversity and maybe change systems, and people getting involved in the student council and just helping out other people, I have no doubt those students will go far.
Yeah.
But I have a huge regret that our education system is failing them, because it is expecting them to fit into this kind of learn and final exam. So to go back to your earlier question, apprenticeships. Let people go out. Let people go out into the workforce and try different things. A lot of other schools, in European schools, after the junior cert, they go to different actual institutions. They don't stay in the same school for 5 years. They can go on, they can go to different apprenticeships, they can try out different things, they can go into the science areas if they wish. I know certain places have, you know, science and mathsy type schools, other places have artsy type schools where they can learn the arts and explore that side of things, and that should be encouraged. But again, that requires vision, investment. It involves it involves sitting down with the stakeholders, not just the teachers, the parents, the school management. I mean, the school management are being pulled every which way. They're trying to facilitate unions and industrial action, other unions who are involved, the managerial bodies, the Department of Education, and they're managing a very difficult juggling act, and we're all trying to do the same thing, which is cater for the students sitting in front of us, but we're all doing it in completely disparate ways, and that needs to change. So the Leaving Cert as it is good. It fits for purpose to a certain extent because it caters for certain students who learn that way. But there needs to be alternatives. It's not about kind of dramatically changing that. It's about offering them alternatives.
I think the biggest failing of the Leaving Cert is just, it is, if anything, just the attitude. And it's that every student is expected these days, they're put under a lot of pressure to sit the Leaving Cert and to move on to third level.
Well, you guys have seen it yourselves. You just come out, the results have been given out a week or two ago, and your CAO places. Yeah. And people's self-worth are very much attached to what they get at points level and what they get offered in college. And it's not a case of, how was your learning experience? You know, how are you now? It's a case of, what did you get? Where are you going? Do you know? And you see it. I mean, you see it in students who maybe don't want to give an answer. I'm particularly thinking of one student who was an incredibly intelligent student, is going back a few years ago now, who did very, very well in the Leaving Cert, but was actually afraid to admit that the course he was doing was a particular course that was, I think there was only a couple of hundred points needed for it, but this is where his passion lay. But he was almost ashamed to admit this is the course he was doing because of the points that he received. People have this stereotypical prejudicial approach that if you get X amount of points, you should be doing an X particular job. Whereas, you know, that completely undermines the integrity of the person and where they're at. So, I mean, it's the pressure is immense. I've seen it myself. I've seen panic attacks, stress. Again, the school that I'm teaching in has teachers present during the Leaving Cert to cater for that. A couple of years ago, I was one of those people who came in, and the school paid me to come in and just be there for kids that were panicking. And that's not right, that they're under that amount of pressure. Yeah. But again, tying in the personal development helps to deal with stress and management and that side of things. So the school are trying to cater for it, but that's a very small scale. This needs to be kind of broadened out, and it needs to be a wider approach. The stress that you guys were under and your year group were under is unnecessary. Do you know? Yeah. It shouldn't be that level, because it becomes something that's actually detrimental. Do you know? And I think from that point of view, if there's an alternative to that, it should be offered. Some students can deal with that, and they deal very well, and they exceed, and most of us, you know, have to deal with stress at some point. So, you know, it's not about kind of getting rid of the stress. It's that's part of the learning curve of life. But it's about giving them alternatives that suit their needs, where they want to go. You know, and that's where I think the education system is failing.
Of course, the media doesn't help either, because you go into any other culture and there is nowhere near as much media coverage as there is surrounding this one set of exams. You go into college, nobody really cares what you get in your exams.
The first news report that I heard the morning that the Leaving Cert results were released this year was that no student had achieved the holy grail of 9 A1s.
It was a negative angle.
Nobody has achieved this. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute here. And again, reminded of several students in our own school who not only passed but did very, very well in a situation where they were expected to possibly fail it. And these students are not being celebrated at all. So the whole media hype, and it's year in, year out. You could almost, just record it once and replay it. It's the same type of stories. You have the newspapers celebrating those students who get the 9 A1s or the 8 A1s, and they're celebrated when the other 64,500 students are just forgotten about, and they're left to plod their own lonely furrow. That's it. Your education is done now. You either go on to college or you go on to work, and by October, does anybody really care about their Leaving Cert results anymore? Do you know? So that says a lot about, what is happening at the moment in education. Mm. It should be something that should be inspiring, lifelong learning, that you go on and you pursue something that fulfills your need to be who you are and express yourself, as opposed to just, points orientated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any more questions, Lou?
No, not really.
Jesus, that was tough. I don't think I've ever concentrated hard.
We really gave you a grueling.
Yeah. Well, it just didn't get personal about our classes, which did get very heated as well.
But. Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Not a problem.
For talking to us about all aspects of the education system.
Good luck in the next year of teaching.
Yeah, I hope.
You have any exciting plans?
Hope Minister Bruton didn't hear it and decide to kind of withdraw me from circulation. But thanks very much.
So thanks again to Michael for that fascinating interview. And we're going to move on now to talk about some things that have been happening since our last episode.
Yep.
The Olympics, finished.
Started and finished, I think.
It had started. Now it's finished.
Yeah, because we took the week off.
We took the week off. We were just so into the Olympics. We were just spending all week watching the Olympics.
Yeah.
I enjoyed quite a lot of the Olympics, actually.
Did you?
I'm not a sports fan, but some of the more peculiar sports are actually very enjoyable.
Okay.
Some of the track and fields that you don't get to see very often, and also there's some interesting sports. There's trampoline gymnastics.
Yeah.
And mountain biking. These are things you don't get to see on television the other 3 years. So it's enjoyable, you know. But
I didn't really watch most of it, to be honest. I watched very little of it. Mm. But I kind of find a lot of the Olympic sports, they're not very engaging to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Like equestrian, what the hell?
I can't disagree with you there.
But there are some very entertaining Olympic sports to watch.
There are.
But of course,
it's been
once again clouded in controversy.
But not the controversy anyone would have expected. I mean, what people were thinking about was Zika virus.
Yep.
Possible terrorism. These sorts of things.
I mean, there's always the doping thing.
Yeah, there's always
the
doping thing was always going to happen with Russia.
Yeah,
but in the end, Zika actually didn't have that major an impact that we know of. At least it hasn't been shown in the media.
Yeah.
To a huge extent, however,
it seems to have been well managed overall.
Yeah. However, there have been more sort of homegrown scandals involved in the Olympics related to the Irish Olympic Council and the people in charge,
which just seems up to a bit weird.
Being up to all sorts of skullduggery.
Skullduggery.
And I don't know what there is to say about that other than the situation is ongoing and, you can't trust anybody anymore.
You can't trust anybody anymore.
But, well done to the people who organized the Rio Olympics. I think they went off relatively successfully, considering a lot of problems they had to contend with.
Yep.
And although obviously there are huge problems with poverty in Rio and the fact that the government spent an enormous amount of money hosting these Olympics that really should have gone elsewhere, they were very enjoyable 2 weeks of sport, and dues must be given there to the fact that they were organized quite well.
Indeed.
And that is about all we have to say about the 2016 Olympics.
Hey, Lou.
Yes.
Hillary is now a fellow podcaster.
She is now trying to steal some of our thunder.
What?
By hosting her own podcast.
So, yeah, she started a new podcast. It's called
With Her.
With Her.
The artwork is her H logo, but with sort of sound waves.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of cool.
It's really cool. I wish the 99% podcast had a
Hillary logo with sound waves.
So cool.
So it's hosted by this guy who's a small business owner. He's not a journalist. He's a small business owner. He's a Hillary supporter. He's
clearly a Hillary supporter.
He is very, very much in favor of
Hillary. He loves Hillary.
He loves Hillary. He wants her to be shown in the best light on her podcast that she is paying for.
Naturally.
We'll play a clip from it.
Yeah.
So basically,
she has two episodes out right now.
Two episodes. The first has her on it. The second one doesn't.
The first one, she declares her dedication to the podcast life.
This is your last chance. If you can bail now, we don't have to do this podcast. But if we do this, then we got to do it. This is your last opportunity to say, I don't want to do it.
The last opportunity? I can't do it midway through?
You can't bail after this. This is the moment. Are we doing it or are we not doing it?
You are really making this hard. Okay, we're doing it.
hear the nice music there.
Really. Yeah, so it seems like a... It
seems like Hillary's really dedicated to her podcasting
project. She's really dedicated to her podcasting project. She also addresses...
Yes.
She also addresses...
Some vicious rumors.
Some vicious rumors. Yeah, play the clip.
I heard a rumor that you don't use an alarm clock.
No, that's not true.
Ah.
That is not true. That's another one of those rumors that people spread.
Oh, another one of those rumors that people spread.
It's terrible.
Well, look, I'm glad that she addressed it because it's obviously an issue that
really
is
affecting
in the heart.
The public's
of
perception of Hillary is really damaged by the perception that she doesn't use an alarm clock.
It's official, folks. She does use an alarm
Hillary
clock.
Hillary Clinton uses
sometimes an alarm clock. She uses her phone, but other times she actually needs to use a real alarm clock.
But see, her dedication to recording this podcast has been called into question somewhat.
Yeah.
Because episode 2 arrives just 1 week later and it begins a bit like this.
Hi, it's Hillary. Welcome back to With Her. My schedule is a little busy this week, so Max is on his own for this episode.
Hillary couldn't come to the phone right now. Please leave a message.
She essentially left a voicemail, and one assumes that the majority of episodes of With Her are going to begin this way.
Well, you know what they say, if you don't get past episode 7, the chances of your podcast succeeding are very bad.
So we'll see what happens.
So she did all of one episode.
Yeah. And the second episode, in fairness to them, did have her running mate Senator Tim Kaine on as a guest.
Yes.
Giving one of the most awkward, trying desperately to sound cool, even though he's like the least cool man in America.
He ticked all the boxes. He ticked his religion.
There are two men.
He talked about his religion. He talked about his family,
music,
his wife, about getting a phone call. What's the episode
name
title?
He's like, honey, Hillary called, or something like that.
Let's get it right.
But I'll tell you something about Tim Kaine.
Honey, I just got a call from Hillary.
Tim Kaine, in this episode, talks so much about his wife and how qualified she is and how he, quote, finds it difficult to be the second best public servant living in their household, that it almost ends up feeling like, why is he running? Why isn't his wife running? She was the Secretary of Education. She quit her post as Secretary of Education to assist him in his campaign and to assist Hillary. And it's kind of like, why is he running at all? He makes a very good case for his wife actually being far more qualified to be Vice President of the United States, but whatever. He also misquotes Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca, and he talks about his harmonica playing, and he, quote, drinks a beer.
A local beer.
And he makes the sound of the beer bottle opening.
A lovely IPA.
Right up next to the microphone, just so we know that he's just like us. He's another humble American Midwestern man.
That was an inserted sound effect as well that they actually put in.
Oh, absolutely. That was absolutely.
That beer opening sound was way too clear.
Yeah.
But look, that's a review of Hillary's pod. We recommend that you definitely check it out.
It is worth listening to. They're very short episodes.
Look, Claire Underwood was the first person to start podding. And
first lady to pod, and Hillary's the second.
Hillary's the second first lady to pod. And
hopefully Bill will be the third.
Exactly. I would actually listen to a Bill pod, though.
You know what? Bill, I think his official title, I found out this week, will be First Gentleman of the United States.
Not just First Husband.
No. First Lady, First Gentleman. Mrs. Obama is referred to as FLOTUS, right? First Lady of the United States.
Yeah.
So what former President Clinton will be called if his wife is elected president is FGOTUS. First Gentleman of the U.S.
FGOTUS.
So we can look forward to FGOTUS, former president, and former POTUS, for POTUS and FGOTUS Clinton, hanging out with POTUS, for POTUS, first woman president of the United States, Hillary Clinton. Now, of course, Hillary hasn't been the only one who's been up to skullduggery this week, because Mr. Trump has also been recruiting some new members for his hate team, including one Mr. Nazi Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage, of course, is the former leader of the UK Independence Party. He was a major figure in the Brexit campaign, though not, I might add, the official Brexit campaign, which was led by Boris Johnson and Michael Gove. He was part of the kind of further right campaign of bigotry that UKIP ran. And Nigel Farage has now quit as leader of UKIP, and he has now decided to take his wares of politics to the United States and interfere with their election. And I think we have a clip of his speech that he made just this morning.
So my advice to you, if you want change in this country, you better get your walking boots on. You better get out there campaigning. I come to you from the United Kingdom with a message of hope and a message of optimism. It's a message that says if the little people, if the real people, if the ordinary decent people are prepared to stand up and fight for what they believe in, we can overcome the big banks. We can overcome the multinationals. And we did it. We made June the 23rd our Independence Day when we smashed the establishment. By doing what we did for Brexit in Britain, we had our own. But I will say this, if I was an American citizen, I wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton if you paid me.
So
I'm sure he could be persuaded with a certain amount of money.
In fact, I wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton if she paid me.
Oh, thanks for clarifying that.
Turn it off. I don't want to hear anymore.
Oh, I wanted to hear. No, I wanted to hear. Donald Trump goes on and
play on, play on.
Hillary Clinton is a bigot who sees people of color.
There we go.
Only as votes, not as human beings worthy of a better future. She's going to do nothing for African Americans. She's going to do nothing for the Hispanics. She's only going to take care of herself, her husband, her consultants, her donors. These are the people she cares about. She doesn't care.
These are the people she cares about.
What her policies have done to your communities. Cash, cash.
Get it off, get it off. Okay. I'm sick of listening to him.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, a few points to make. First of all, Nigel Farage is a British citizen, not an American citizen. If Hillary Clinton brought somebody who wasn't an American citizen on stage to make a speech and tried to convince people to vote for her, Donald Trump would have a field day.
Yeah.
He would have a field day yelling about how this person has no right to express an opinion on the U.S. election. They're not a citizen. So, first of all, we have hypocrisy there. Secondly, Nigel Farage talking about helping the poor, ordinary people against the big banks and the big corporations is a little sketchy.
Yeah, it's not only a little sketchy. I mean, he's worked for...
He is the big banks, the big corporations. He is a human embodiment.
A huge number of banks, financial services. Mm-hmm.
He has
been directly involved in the financial
exactly.
sector. So
if anyone is responsible within those institutions for, causing suffering to the lives of the poor, ordinary people, Nigel Farage is probably that person.
I mean, yeah. So, I mean, Nigel Farage worked for Refco, which, you know, is involved in steel. He was involved, but also he was involved with the credit Lyonnais Rouge, which is a French bank or financial services company. So, like, he has worked for many, many financial services
companies.
But
this is just the same kind of thing that Trump... This is the same thing that Trump does.
It is exactly the same thing as Trump.
Exactly the same. He twists the truth to...
So they're a perfect match. But, I mean, Farage is... He stepped down as leader of UKIP.
He literally has no political position. I mean, his job is Minister of European Parliament. But he just led a campaign for his country to leave Europe and no longer have involvement in the European Parliament. So in theory, he's unemployed.
So he has lost his job.
Yeah. Although he does still attend their meetings just so he can shout and be laughed at by his colleagues. I mean, this was inevitable, I think. I mean, I never really thought that Nigel Farage would go this far. I don't know why I doubted it. It seems kind of obvious.
Because when he was questioned after Brexit about supporting Donald Trump, he didn't sound like he was going to endorse him. Or in any way, shape,
or form.
Seems like he was just like, okay.
He's a nationalist of the same breed as Trump, to the extent that I would think he doesn't see any need for him to interfere with the U.S. election, and he doesn't think it's his right. I actually thought he might at least have that attitude, that it wasn't his place. And, like, I don't think that people from other countries expressing opinions on political situations in other countries is a huge problem. But for people like Trump and Farage, who see foreigners as a horrendous threat, I'm actually surprised that one of them would go and make a speech for another country's population about their election.
Indeed.
Indeed. Anyway, enough about those awful, horrible people. I have a question for you now, Michael.
Oh.
see you're doing a bit of research there, Michael, on your laptop. You have to look it up. Because this question gets more complicated every week. Okay, I'll give you a sec.
Wait.
Have the Fine Gael minority government collapsed yet?
No.
Good. We're moving on now to one of my favorite segments in the show. It's called... Kevin Spacey Film of the Week. Every week we talk about a Kevin Spacey film and we recommend you go watch it. Send us in your reviews. We got so many reviews of our last Kevin Spacey Film of the Week, which was Nine Lives. People had a lot of strong opinions about that film, yep. About the talking cat.
A lot of words being said.
Neither of us have seen it yet.
No.
But we will soon.
We will soon. When it comes to DVD and is in the bargain bin for
25 cents in CEX shop, we will buy it.
We will buy it.
That's how we usually watch quality
films.
That's
how we usually watch them.
So this week's Kevin Spacey Film of the Week is a film that Kevin Spacey is... His role in it is kind of a secret that when you approach the film, you're not really supposed to know he's in the film.
Okay.
So by telling you that this is Kevin Spacey Film of the Week, we're actually spoiling one of the most enjoyable twists in the film.
Oh. Sort of.
And that film is Seven, or you may pronounce it Sevenen. Because the V is a seven.
Seven
stars.
Oh, I see what they did there.
Seven is directed by David Fincher, the man who brought you Fight Club and Gone Girl and all that. And it's a very, very excellent cop thriller. Brad Pitt, Morgan Freeman, and Gwyneth Paltrow are in it. It's basically the two detectives, and they are following the trail of a sadistic serial killer in a modern American city. He's basically murdering people, and he's taking inspiration for his murders from the Seven Deadly Sins. So the murders are very creative and crafty, but also very horrific and disturbing, and the two detectives kind of struggle with both solving the crimes and the psychological aspect of what they're investigating. Kevin Spacey shows up in the last probably 40 minutes of the film only, but he is extremely memorable, has a very, very strong impact in his role. And he ends up being more or less the star of the film because he's really, really terrific, very creepy in it. It's a really fantastic film.
The creepy thing.
Just creepy
very well.
It was one of that and Fight Club were the films that really cemented David Fincher as one of the best directors of his generation, which I think he is personally. And Seven is possibly his best film. So I would recommend you
David Fincher.
They love him in France. So I would highly recommend you go and check out Seven.
I haven't seen it. I'm going to go watch it.
You should watch it. You'd actually really like it.
I think I would.
It's a very enjoyable
film. Seems like my kind of movie.
It's very, very intense, but a very, very enjoyable film. And wonderful editing and music. And the opening credits are a brilliant short film in and of themselves.
Yeah.
So I would recommend watching that. So that is our Kevin Spacey Film of the Week. And send us in your reviews on Twitter and Facebook. And we will read some out next week if we have time. I think now we're going to go on to Low Stakes Cereal.
Let's do it.
Now, Low Stakes Cereal, we have a bit of an audio clip to play in a moment.
Okay.
From YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
And this is something that I noticed during the week and I found slightly questionable. So, this is an ad that RTE, our national broadcaster, are playing to advertise themselves, paying the license fee, supporting RTE. This is basically an ad for RTE. Mm. And they have a whole series of these. They're called We Were There. So there's one about the Eurovision, the Rose of Tralee, people winning Olympic medals, Ireland doing well at the European Championships. They're all about big moments that have been witnessed by RTE. But then some of these moments that they're choosing are not as triumphant, and this is one of them.
The video images that were coming in were horrific and upsetting and shocking, but at the same time, you know, they told a story. When the second tower collapsed, everybody stopped. The phones were still ringing, the radios were still on, but everyone just stopped and stared at the monitors.
Paint pay your TV license, guys, and we'll show you terrorists destroying American architecture live every time.
Yeah, so that was, if you couldn't gather that from the audio, that was a series of clips.
From the September 11th attacks?
In New York.
Do you think that's... Do you share my view that this is a bit of a questionable way to advertise a national broadcaster? I
don't
know. I see what they're doing, but I think they didn't do it particularly well.
I do think it was... Yeah, for an ad.
For an ad.
It would seem... I would seem at home in a documentary.
Yeah.
But for an ad to pay your TV license?
Yeah.
No.
I think there are ways to try and persuade people that a broadcaster does its job well and is worth contributing to financially. Yeah. And I think that reminding them that you... that they were the people who showed you some of the most troubling images ever broadcast on television, 15 years ago, isn't a particularly ethical way. And also, it's really, you're using these images to sell a service, essentially.
Yeah.
That's what an ad is.
Yeah.
You're using these images to sell a service. I don't know. It's not a huge thing, but that's what Low Stakes Cereal is all about. And, Orzee continued to frustrate me in many, many ways, and this is just one example.
That wouldn't really my TV license.
If I was
anymore.
An editor in Orzee and somebody had said, will you cut together some footage from September 11th to advertise with, that would have not sat easy with me. But Orzee also recently, during the Olympics opening ceremony, they cut to an ad break during their coverage.
During the ceremony?
Yes. Now, they did it at a very, very bad moment, because the entire ceremony, it was 3.5 hours long, probably, in the middle, an hour long athletes parade. They didn't cut away from the athletes parade, but when it goes to an important educational section about climate change, showing a video about what humans can do to respond to climate change,
oh, you're kidding me.
Orzee cut straight to an ad break and told us all about cheese and dairy and new shoes that we can buy and new places we can pollute with cars. So Orzee cut away from the most important part of the ceremony, it's just stupid. It just frustrates me.
Mm.
Now, to finish today's show, we have a classic album.
We do have a classic album of the week.
Now, Michael, what's this week's classic album? Because I know we were on a little road trip last week.
We went on a little road trip.
We went to a national park.
during our week off, we decided to go on a cleanse.
So we went to a national park and climbed a tall hill. And we appreciate the government for keeping these national parks
open.
We
actually do. I mean, look... Free entry. The place was packed.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful sunny day.
One of the nicest days of the year.
There were locals. There were foreign tourists. It was great.
Oh, it was great.
Yeah.
So in
the car on the way there.
Yeah, it's about an hour journey.
We listened to this fantastic classic album. We had to revisit it after a few years, but it's a really great album. And what's the album called?
Life in Cartoon Motion
by Mika. Do I attract you? Do I repulse you with my queasy smile? Am I too dirty? Am I too flirty? Do I like what you like? I could be wholesome, I could be loathsome, guess I'm a little bit shy. Why don't you like me? Why don't you like me without making me try? I try to be like Chris Kelly, but all the looks were too sad. Tried a little Freddy. I've got an entity mind. So this song is called Grace Kelly, biggest hit off the album.
Yep.
Great song. It's a great album. Very, very Mika is a very unique singing style.
Very.
And I think his songs have a great, really great energy to them.
Oh, they do, yeah. What else should I play?
The song is just full of hits. I don't know. Anything you want. Oh, this is good. Oh, the arrangement of the song is just marvelous. Joyous. Everybody's gonna love today, gonna love today, gonna love today. Everybody's gonna love today, gonna love today. Any way you want to, any way you've got to. Love, love me. And that is
Life in Cartoon Motion by Mika.
And we would recommend you go listen to it on Spotify or iTunes or whatever.
Yeah, totally. That is our classic album of the week. We actually picked a great classic album this
week.
It is a good album.
It is a legitimate classic. You should all go listen to it. It will enrich your weeks, enrich your lives.
For sure.
So that's all we have time for this week on the 99%.
Yeah.
Thank you to Michael Purcell again for joining us.
Great interview.
And thanks to you, Michael.
Thank you, Lou. And another great show. People can find you over in buzzhub.info.
Or buzzhubnews.com.
Or buzzhubnews.com.
Whatever the new, you want. Yeah, and carbdigital.com.
Floats your boat.
And I am Revolutionary on Twitter. You are McKendry Tweets. You can find all the episodes of the show at 99pshow.com. You can follow us 99pshow on Twitter, facebook.com/99pshow, 99pshow on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back very soon with more great podcasting from the 99%.
For sure.
Thanks for tuning in.
We'll see you next week, everybody.
Have a nice week. Goodbye. Yeah.